Greetings, listeners. It's Greg Shirley here again, and we're here to talk science. It's been a while, I know, and it's great to have you along. And today is a very, very special day because we have a very special person along with us, taking the advantage of her presence, staying with us here in New Zealand, all the way from Belgium, Dr. Anouk Mertens. Anouk and I met in Samoa while I was working there for the United Nations Environment Programme, and she was working for the United Nations Development Programme. It sounds like we were separated, but we weren't. Actually, we were working in the same building. And Anouk came and saw me one day and said, "I'd like to work with you." And I said, "Oh, that's a compliment, if ever I heard one." So it turned out in the end that Anouk was able to work with me, not for me, but with me, as an intern. It's a great system that the United Nations has, as do other agencies around the world, whereby younger people can learn some skills in a brand new circumstance, like in the South Pacific and the Southwest Pacific particularly. And so Anouk worked with me for at least 6 months, I think, wasn't it? And it was a great privilege. I was just joking with Catherine Scullin, the station director and manager, that my productivity at least doubled with the company of people like Anouk. So enough of that by way of introduction. It's good to be back again, and we'll be back monthly talking science with myself. But for today, I'm going to put the ball over the net to Anouk, and she can talk a little bit about herself. Maybe something about what she's doing now, her current position and broad interests. Thank you, Anouk.
Hi, Greg, and thank you for your kind words and kind introduction and for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today. My name is Dr. Anouk Mertens, or just Anouk, if you like. I'm currently employed as a grant writer at the University of Leuven in Belgium, which is a very ancient, big university in the heart of Belgium, basically. So I help professors with their grant applications, mainly for EU projects. On the side of that, I'm also a research fellow at that same university, so at the University of Leuven, and as well as a research associate at the University of Aruba. So my interests lie in grant writing, project management, and I also have a strong love for small island states in general.
Right. Yeah. So you're hearkening back to Samoa days and working in the South Pacific. Cool. And the University of Aruba, could you explain just very quickly where that university is and how it's tagged to Belgium?
Yeah, so Aruba is a small island state, about 180 square kilometers and a population of 120,000 people, just in front of the coast of Venezuela. So when you're on the island, you actually see Venezuela on the other side. And it's actually part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands, so it's an independent state, but still under the Kingdom of the Netherlands.
Right.
And I used to work with them on this education project.
I see. Yeah. Okay, and so when I knew you in Samoa, you were doing a masterate and excelling at that and passed that, and then you went further in excelling, I have to say, in winning a scholarship to do a PhD study. And this was very much environmentally focused. I was wondering whether you'd like to tell us about that, and we'll move through that and then get to your work in the small island developing states, I hope, if we have time.
Yeah, so my research was on the organizational challenges of local maize or corn for the bioeconomy.
Right.
So if you speak about the bioeconomy, basically it means that the economies Everything to do with economy, that is, or all products that are made from biological sources. So that involves food and feed as things we would think of immediately, but also materials and energy.
Right.
When you talk about the bio-based economy, we speak more about, we neglect actually the food and feed component, and we only talk about using biological materials for the production of materials and energy. So right. That's that component.
Would food and feed also include food or, sustenance for animals? Because there's a lot of crops grown, I think, for feeding cattle and
especially in Belgium and in Europe, there's a lot of that growing. So that I would consider feed everything that's destined towards animals. And food, everything that's destined for human consumption.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you go about doing this study, and what were the main questions? Why were you studying?
What I saw in Belgium is that there was a lot of effort to get this bio-based or bioeconomy going. There was a lot of research being done on the technological side. So there were a lot of research labs doing excellent work on working with these materials and trying to convert them into more valuable products like materials and like fuels.
Yes.
On the other hand, we also saw lots of economists looking into it and looking at the techno-economic feasibility of these studies, and both had actually really good results, but when we looked at practice, we saw nothing was happening on the practice side. And so I thought that more research needed to be done on those organizational challenges. So what is hampering actually the fact that we move from the lab or the research that's being done towards practice? What is hampering farmers, machine makers, and investors in these new technologies of really making that investment and really going a step further than just research?
So you were concerned at finding what the blockages were in the system for getting the results of this research, which is intrinsically valuable and useful, but you could see that notwithstanding its value and the benefits, it wasn't actually being put into practice in the field at the farmer level, at the dirt level, so to speak, you might say. So you were looking for where these blockages were, so to speak. Would correctly. That be a reasonable summary?
Yeah, it's a very good summary, and actually what they would call it is the valley of debt. So really where you have excellent research being done with good results, and then a valley of debt where nothing is done with that research to put it into practice. And the bioeconomy or bio-based economies was one of those areas where there would be a huge valley of debt, so to speak.
Can you give us an example of, an area of research or a discovery, so to speak, a piece of technology, whatever, that you can think of that occurred, that you discovered, and how that was not, it was blocked, if you like, from getting used in the field. Can you think?
Yeah.
Give us a one or two examples of that, please.
For example, in Belgium, we grow a lot of maize or corn, and when we harvest the grains, we usually leave that corn stover, what we say, the remaining of the plant, on the fields, and it's there to digest and to keep the soil healthy.
Yes.
But it's been calculated that you can also take off part of that stover off the land and actually make from that stover, you can make like really essential building blocks for materials, and those building blocks could be like used for any substitute for plastics, for example, or like kind of rubber materials. You could produce that from that corn stover, and if you would take only part of the corn stover away without reducing the fertility of your land.
Oh, okay.
So they calculated it's possible. It was technically possible. It was economically viable, but nobody was looking into how why it wasn't happening or nobody was interested. And so I went to talk to the farmers.
Yeah.
If they even heard of this possibility, what would be their concerns if they would start to sell their corn stover? Yeah. I would go and talk to the machinery people, those that make the harvesting machines.
Yeah.
And I would go and talk to some of the investors. And we have this thing in Flanders, is the Bioeconomy Valley. So it's like an innovation hub for the bioeconomy.
Yeah.
What would be the main issues? And the main issues were basically, we calculated, it's not necessarily the technology, it's not necessarily we can solve everything with technological solutions, but it was really the way people needed to collaborate because of the small field sizes in Flanders, because of the logistical parts, and everybody needed to collaborate.
Yeah.
And what I found was that people weren't even talking to each other, so the farmers weren't talking to the end suppliers.
Right.
And at that moment, I found out also that in Ontario, Canada, they were doing something similar research.
Yeah.
But they were way ahead. They were already building the factory, and they were already making the contracts with the farmers to go and collect the corn stover. So I went for a while to Canada, and there I see you can do it basically. Well, the organization should be more within groups, so people would organize themselves in would organize themselves into basically one company,
okay,
rather than having individual farmers and sellers. But
we call it a cooperative.
Yeah, cooperative. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I was looking for the word.
Yeah, yeah.
But so a cooperative would work the best. Mm. And what I did was take that example also from Canada and applied it to the Flemish case study.
Yeah.
And did some modeling about it, and I saw that basically the main gap actually in setting up such a supply chain would be fluctuations in how much corn stover you can collect every year if farmers are allowed to choose every year how much corn they would produce. And if you would do it in a cooperative, the supply chain would be allowed to be more stable, and it would also make the investment more reliable.
So it's an economies of scale thing, as well as a reliability of supply.
Yes. Yeah. I think I was the first one in Belgium to put all these people together on the same table and let them talk about these results and what it would mean for Flanders. Yeah.
And how did you find the people interacted? Were they positive? And did it need much facilitation?
No, I think farmers were of course concerned about their soil health. They didn't want to get all the soil, all the stover removed from their fields because that might affect their soil health. And they were also a bit concerned about having more machinery on their fields that would condense the soil too much.
Compact
the soil too much. The machinery investors were concerned about that their machine would not be able to work enough hours to make it
economically
viable.
Yeah.
And the investors were concerned about the continuous supply and the quality of the stover. And just having them talk it through, they really saw potential. And then also I could present them with the case of Canada, where they were already setting it up. They saw the potential. But
and this word stover, is it?
Stover, yeah, corn stover.
Corn stover.
It's really the remainder. If you have the corn plant, it's only the remainder. You take, if it's corn is harvested and you only harvest the grain, it's everything that remains on the field afterwards. So it's the plant as well as the kernel.
So would that be mainly lignin?
It's mainly lignin based.
So folks listening, lignin is one of the substances produced by plants to give rigidity or strength to a plant so it can basically stand up and be a structure. And I think there might be quite a lot of it in corn, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So taking that out of the system, the soil ecosystem, if you like, because it's just basically carbon and hydrogen. Yeah. You know, it's not new, not the minerals.
Not the minerals, but you would take out the carbon out of the soil, and the carbon in the soil would also provide structure for your soil. So you also need that carbon to go back into the soil to provide structure.
Right.
So you cannot take it all.
No. And did the machinery required have to be modified, be different in any way?
Yes, because, you have to know the Belgian climate a bit, but it's quite wet at the moment the corn is harvested. Things can get really, it's the end of October, and that's our start of our, middle of our autumn, start of our winter, colder season and wet fields. And so if you would go on with heavy machinery, that would lead to highly compacted fields. So you would have to have special tires that wouldn't compact the fields as much. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So was there much uptake of this new way of doing things?
I left this topic before I could really see the results. I don't think there's currently anything done on a large scale with corn stover, but I'm quite confident people are still looking into it because it's such a... it's a crop that is grown so much in Belgium. It's a crop that really easily grows in Belgium. So basically any farmer can really take a patch of land and grow corn on it. Mm. And it's a valuable resource.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And how would you feel, would there be much application for this principle elsewhere in the world or in other areas of agriculture? And would this, in turn, I can intuitively think that this might relate to the circular economy that we hear about. And perhaps you'd like to talk a little bit about the circular economy so that we know what we're talking about. This is me putting the ball conveniently over the net to you.
You speak about, I explained the bioeconomy, the bio-based economy, and the circular economy takes it even a step further and is this idea of an economy where we reuse all materials and we continuously recycle all the materials we use continuously. So we don't need to use any virgin material anymore, and we don't bring in any virgin fossil fuels anymore, for example, for using making new plastics and these kind of things. So currently we're mainly living in this linear economy where we produce, consume, and then put it into waste. The circular economy would be an economy where you close actually the cycle and don't produce any waste anymore, but it's like a closed system. Yeah. And in that way, it links to it because you would grow your corn. You could use the kernels or the grains for food or feed, so for human consumption and for animal feed. And you could at the same time use that remainder of the stock to produce like high value materials.
Yes.
And those materials would then be also biodegradable. So you could somehow maybe after a while recirculate it to the soil.
Right.
I'm not too sure how that works, so that would go into the more technical details. Yeah. But it would be more close, and you could close off the land. And I did it about corn. But basically, you could have done this study about anything, any plant material all over the world where you would grow something and you could take parts for food and feed and take parts for material production.
Yeah.
And you would try to create a more closed system,
not
a linear system.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds fantastic. Like, I can see lots of multiple benefits there too. I was wondering, this concept that you've been investigating through your PhD and you've described how the circular economy applies, it's relevant for that as well. Just moving into the small island development scenario, can you comment about how applicable these ideas are to small island developing states? Would you have any thoughts about this, having worked further afield than I? You've worked in the Pacific and you've worked now in the Caribbean as well. You have outreached me in your experience. So well, perhaps you'd like to make some comment about this.
Yeah, I think it's a very relevant concept for small island states, because they're, by definition, they're islands, they're more remote from mainland, and they're bounded. And what we see now in small island states is this, actually, Professor Singh from the University of Waterloo calls it the metabolism of islands in this linear economy, where you would, and this globalization that we see now, where you would bring products from outside in that economy, and what you left is with the waste. So it's like a congested system that continuously, like many small island states, would have major waste issues, and it's actually not their fault, and they don't have a lot of land spare for waste dumping sites or for management of that waste. So waste is a major issue, and if you would reconnect that to the circularity, and I think before globalization happened and before there was colonization of these islands and other factors coming in external and influencing their economies, there would be rather circular economies. I think looking at Samoa, the coconut tree is such an important thing, not only for the coconut and its nutritional value, but the rest would go to any pigs, for example, and then you would make brooms out of the the leaves, and then you made the roofs out of the leaves, and there's so much value into a coconut tree that is more than just the coconut or the flesh itself.
Yeah, not to mention all the culture that goes with these plants too.
And then the Samoan people would notice intuitively that this is a very important tree, and they would live circular. But now we changed that whole system into a linear economy, and it's creating a lot of issues.
Yeah, that's right. So, do you think that, though historically the movement between islands, was that different in the cultural interchange and the early peoples, islanders, colonization and mixing that was going on, was that disturbing the circular economy that they might have had pre-colonial times, or do you think it would have been just adding a bit of colour and enhancing perhaps?
I didn't do research on it, but I can think of that it might have made that circular economy a bit larger, but at least they were working probably all of them with biological materials that were also biodegradable, therefore.
Yeah,
it might have caused disruptions here and there by an overuse of some resource and an underuse or another resource. I'm not saying that there might not have been any disruptions, but at least I think they were creating them probably a circular economy on a larger areas between islands.
And so do you think that there's a good appetite for, in the small island developing state countries and territories, do you think there's an appetite for these ideas with the circular economy and minimizing waste and so on?
I think so. I think many small island states see their waste issues and they're not blind to it, and they're really trying to solve it. And there's great examples in the Pacific and SPREP, the South Pacific Regional Environment Program, doing great work on waste management in those in the Pacific small islands. In Aruba, there's, for example, there's also a whole circular economy a group or people working on it and collaborating on it. But it's not an easy problem to solve. And as I explained with my PhD, it's not only about technological fixes. It's really also about context, understanding the local context and how you can apply this concept of the circular economy within their own local context.
Right.
So
you
would first need to understand what's happening, where are the waste streams, and how, and understand culture and context
right.
before you can even start thinking about the technological solution. The technological solutions are usually there, but it's I think I found with my research it's more complicated than just having a technological quick fix implementing somewhere.
So do you think that fundamentally, culturally, there is an opportunity for technology and the circular economy to blend? Are you optimistic about it being a solution for the future? I know this is a very difficult question, but it might be something that's occurred to you.
Yeah, I think I am always optimistic, or I try to be always optimistic and see opportunity. I think there's a way forward. I think, we need to spend enough resources. I think not only looking at the technology, also looking at economies of scale, which is a thing for small island states. Of course, some technologies cost just too much money to have it just on implemented just for one island, and then that brings then a whole logistical chain that you might not even be able to realize.
Yeah.
So it's those things are complex and need to be, as I said, researched on local context.
And find out what will actually work.
But I'm sure if you do the sufficient research and work together with the local communities and understand their needs and then work from there, I'm sure lots of can be done, and I'm
quite
positive.
Good things can happen. Cool. Excellent. Well, Anouk, thank you very much indeed for the interview. I really enjoyed it.
And
I've learned a lot. I thought I knew quite a bit already, having known you so long, but I obviously didn't. So on behalf of the listeners and the station, thank you very, very much for spending some time with us. I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Thank you. Me too. Thank you so much.
All the best.
This program was produced at and first aired on Coast Access Radio with support from Erirangi Te Motu, New Zealand On Air. Stay up to date with the latest episodes available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.